Wow. Wow. That's the first time I've ever had a video introduction. It took me by surprise. Well, good morning. As you can tell, I'm a Brit, and what an honour it is to be here. First and foremost, Dan, Rhonda, thank you so much for the honour of joining you at the conference and speaking here to the exec team of One Focus. An honour to be a part of this. And I want to say a huge thank you and honour to my senior pastors, Stuart and Irene Bell, who I get the joy of serving with daily, and they're my spiritual parents, and it's because of them that I'm able even to stand here today and talk on the subject that is so passionate to my heart of worship. I am 45, I nearly added another year to my life. I've grown up in the church. I grew up in an Anglican church, a Church of England church, in the very centre of the UK, in the Midlands area. And when I was 19, I moved to Lincoln, which is a city of around about 110,000, 120,000 people on the east coast of England, about 2 hours north of London. So if you can imagine a picture of the UK, we're up the same side of as London on the right-hand side of the nation on the east coast. And I moved there to become and train to be a primary school teacher. So in our context, that's children from the age of 4 up to the age of 11. And I studied music alongside primary education with a specialism of training and teaching age 7 to 11. So if in any way today I talk to you as though you are children, please forgive me. It's just my background coming out of me. I taught for 7 years in primary education. And alongside that, I was active in the life of the church, as we were called New Life at the time. I was active in there in the realm of worship. And I was doing that thing where, for many of us in a bivocation, we do where we live our life out there in the world. I was teaching from 9 till 3:30. But of course, anyone who's involved in teaching knows that it goes way more than that. But then I was coming home from that, and I was actually working into a Christian recording studio as well, and we were developing the sound, really, of the local church. We were working alongside the local church. We used a phrase called grassroots worship, and we were partnering with those who were self-funding and releasing songs of the church into the nation at that time. And I did that for about 3 years, partnering the two together, and then they converged, really, and there were some projects that brought extra finance in, and I was able to step out of teaching and into the world of the recording studio, a Christian recording studio. But alongside that, I was beginning and being developed in my world, work world of worship pastoring, leading a team, and after 4 years in the recording studio, I then became full-time in the ministry at the local church, leading the worship team and the creative arts ministry, ultimately into media and all of the things that come with the worlds that for many of us we inhabit. And I led a team for about 18 years, was involved in the weekly rhythm of a worship team. Just give me a quick show of hands if you are a worship leader, worship pastor, involved in worship ministry at any level. Great, a whole number of you. So you know what that rhythm feels like. That rhythm of rehearsals, that rhythm of choosing songs, that rhythm of hearing from God and then implementing that as part of a Sunday service. I was involved intrinsically in that rhythm for many years. And then had the privilege and honour of also leading worship and being part of the Sung Worship for our network, which is called Ground Level. And we run across the course of the year, we run a leaders conference in the April of every year. And Pastor Dan and Rhonda have been over for that. Jack and Trish have been there. Many of you have actually been to that leaders conference. And then we run for the whole network and for the wider church a celebration event over the August bank holiday weekend, the last weekend in August, which gathers around 7,000 people on a showground. Everybody camps together in tents, and we put a big top up there, and we enjoy the presence of God amongst multiple thousands as we gather together. And I've had the honour and privilege of being part of that team and leading a team there. My musical background started when I was 5. I was sent by my mum and dad, probably dragged is a better word, to piano lessons, and for the first number of years, hated it. Really didn't like it, didn't like my piano teacher, didn't like the practice of week in, week out, playing scales and doing all of that rudimentary stuff to make me a musician. And then all of a sudden, things began to click. And I suppose in my early teenage years, music began to become, I suppose, the second passion of my heart. I discovered Jesus, and then I discovered worshiping and expressing my love of Jesus through music. I led my first worship band at the age of 13. Well, I say that. I mean, we had no idea we were a worship band. We were just a group of friends who were thrown together. Every Easter, we'd go to an event called Spring Harvest in England, and we'd be given, or we'd buy, this songbook of songs that were permeating the church. And in the church I was growing up, these songs were fresh and new to us. So we'd come home and we'd carry this songbook and we'd use this songbook in the life of the church. And the vicar at the time was gracious to allow a bunch of 13, 14 and 15 year olds to run riot, really, and have a bit of chaos in evening services. And I'm sure at times he had no idea what was going on, and neither did we, really. And but my journey in all of this brought me then into New Life. We're now called Alive. We changed our name 5 or so years ago, and brought me into a charismatic church where worship had such a rich heritage. Sung worship had such a rich heritage. There was a gentleman there, as I arrived, by the name of Chris Bowater, who was in the UK and worldwide, actually, at the centre of that rebirth of singing and songs from the 1970s, and this whole new fresh wave of a new expression of worship. And he was the worship leader in the church at the time. And I'd grown up with one of his tapes. Remember those things? One of his tapes in our car. We were listening to an album called Time for Tears. And I remember his voice. I remember sitting in the balcony at New Life on my very first Sunday in the city, sitting there and never having seen him. It wasn't in the days of Facebook and all of the kind of social media that we live in. But I recognized his voice. And I recognized the songs that were being sung. And there was just this sense that I felt at home. I'd walked into a place where I felt at home. And since that point, I've been pastored and led and grown and developed, discipled in that church. I've been there now since 1993. And it's the joy of my heart to be amongst the people that God has placed me with. So today, we're going to talk about trends in worship, the trends that I see. And they're from my context. I hope that they relate to the US in some way. They certainly seem, as I've reflected on them over the last day, they certainly seem to be in line with the words that we're hearing and the flow of the Spirit over the conference this year. And I've got 6 thoughts for us today. But let's start with trends. So I honestly thought for about 5 or 6 nanoseconds when Dan mentioned the phrase trends in worship, I honestly thought he'd ask me for 45 minutes to talk about hipsters. I thought he was going to ask me to talk about top buns, you know, and beards and tattoos and leading worship with a cup of coffee in your hand. I thought that was going. Now, I love hipsters. I wish I was one, you know. I'm 40. I can't grow a beard. I am 45. I have not been blessed with that. So I tip my hat to you, hipsters. You look amazing, and we all wish you we were of you. But of course, the word trends, its very self, means this. The Cambridge Dictionary defines it as this: a general development or change in a situation or in the way that people are behaving. Before I left to fly to the US, in our news, we had, obviously we've got Brexit going on, which I'm sure you've heard about it. But we had another one of the stalwarts of the UK high street, a travel agent called Thomas Cook, who had existed for nearly 180 years, who went bust. They had, I think, about 250,000 Brits somewhere out in the world, of which the government then had to bring back. They had something like 500-odd high street stores of Thomas Cook and 25,000 staff members based across the globe, and they went bust. One of the reasons in the Financial Times for why they went bust was this. They suffered as customers shifted from the high street to the internet. They didn't keep up with trends. They didn't keep up with the way that the world was working. And because of the size of the organization, they were slow to move. And they got overtaken by the very nature that you and I can now go on the internet and we can do all of our own travel plans. We no longer need a travel agent to stand in our way. So there's always going to be trends. There are always going to be things that move and shift. Of course, the very nature of being trendy or catching up with trends is the fact that it is fickle in some way. Things will come and take over. that trend will no longer be trendy, for want of a better term. So as we look at these six trends, I'd love us to ask a couple of questions over the whole of this, some more overarching questions as to why are we asking this question. I'd love us to think, God, what are you doing now in worship? I'd love us to ask the question, what must remain, but what renewed forms of worship would you like to further reform? I think we all understand, and we've certainly heard it over the last day or so, that actually worship is initiated by God. It starts in him. It's an invitation by him to join him in what he's doing. It's not something that we've creatively come up with. The essence and the nature of God is this dialogue, it's this communication that we're all involved in and we take part in. So God, what are you doing in worship? How can we respond to where you are moving and what you are doing? So my context, I'm UK, of course, and I suppose at a musical style level, we would very much find ourselves in the CCM model. Very many of the songs that we've sung this morning are songs that we are singing in the life of our church. It's the anthems, I suppose, of the age. I suppose it's the big trend in this season of our life is that we're being drawn towards that common sound across the earth in many ways. So I speak from my perspective and I humbly offer six thoughts for us today about trends in worship. If some of them relate to what you see, then brilliant. If you see things in different ways, even better. Because we're a rich perspective, we carry rich perspective amongst us. This whole sense of converging together is really what we're celebrating. This celebration of us coming together. And I've taken that word, converge, and as I've used this in my points and my titles, I suppose what I'm saying is that I see some things and I urge us to bring those things to a point of convergence. Because I believe in God that actually when we stand and pull those things together, that actually we may not be seeing the trend of these currently, but there could be a future trend that could pull us into something glorious in our united God. So if our first trend is this, I see a convergence of community and experience. A convergence of community and experience. You only have to put Sung Worship into YouTube to immediately understand that as the church moves forward in our contemporary structures, that we are longing for community. We are longing to be in places that commune together. You know, you see campfires now in YouTube worship. You see chapels. You see factories where people gather in big, vast spaces, but they're small groups gathered in that place. You see worship taking place in living rooms, in coffee shops, in places where people are gathering already. There is this sense of community, people being drawn together, and in the sense of being drawn together, putting Christ right at the center of their communal gathering. So there's a sense of us being pulled to community. Choirs, singing in circles, even the layout of our rooms now. You know, we're no longer just all of a sudden, we've become very conscious that we're looking towards the stage, but also we're now looking towards each other. We've understood that we're now in community together. Part of my own practice in worship now is every so often in sung worship is to lift my head and look around because I'm called to be in community. As I stepped into this, I'm in community. I'm with my brothers and sisters in Christ. We are the great family of God gathered together. We're in community. I'd encourage you to do the same. You know, I'm not a worship leader who encourages people to close their eyes and just have a one-to-one moment with God. I don't believe in communal singing and what we do. That's actually what we're called to be a part of. It's part of it, but it's only a part of it. We're called to stand alongside one another. We're called to be in community. We're called to be the people who sing with one another, to look into each other's eyes, to actually say we're here together. So there's a great trend, I believe, towards community. It's a trend towards reclaiming the high participation, community-orientated practices of worship. But it's also a huge trend, and it's been going on now for a number of years, towards experiences. Concerts, conferences, a great sense of moving towards great experiences. There's a desire in all of us to have an experience. Going to stadiums, going and watching and being a part of a tour. There's so many things now as, again, you look out there and see there's an experiential worship. But I believe that God is calling us to a combination
a convergence of those two areas, community and experience. The development of experience is helping drive the desire for greater experiential encounter. The nature of experience is it draws me to a desire for greater experience. Once I've experienced something that touches me, emotionally connects me to it, it draws me to find the next thing. So I chase the next thing. I chase the next concert tour, or I chase the next conference. I go seeking the experience. And that is inherently birthed into culture. It's a consumeristic culture. It's a sense of trying to buy into the next thing that will make me complete. But let's not kid ourselves. It's in the church as well. It's in us, the people of God. We're lured into this. You know, it's that iPhone mentality, isn't it? You know, the new iPhone 11 is now out. And all of a sudden, culture draws itself towards that will fix my, you know, despondent nature of iPhone 10 or whatever the latest one is. But there's this sense that in all of us, we're seeking an experience. I believe that the trend will pull us towards a convergence of community and experience, where the experiences that we're looking for and the experiences that we're seeking will be found in community. It won't be found in the things that we can't grasp, but it will be found in the rawness and the uniqueness of the people that God has placed us into. I believe there's a convergence of community and experience. As I go through each of these points, I'm going to just throw a few thoughts and ideas out for worship leaders as well, little takeaways, little nuggets that you can perhaps consider. This first one around experience. So really, worship leaders, remember you're up against it. The world is screaming experiences at us. It's screaming bigger and better. It's screaming greater front-led, platform-led mentalities. You can't keep up with that. You can't compete with it. You can't lead your people into those levels of experience that concert tours and all of that with financial resource behind it can do. So don't try and compete. There's no need. There's no need. Work with what's in your hand. Celebrate what God has given you. And understand that you are unique in Christ. You are unique in God. And celebrate the local church. Celebrate the community of God that he's placed you in. You know, we're not all going to sing like the models that we see on YouTube. We're not all going to sound like that. But that's brilliant. It is so brilliant that we're not chasing after that. But you're up against it. You know, we've all heard that, haven't we? People arrive back from a conference and arrive that morning with their songbook in their hands. You've got to sing these songs. We've got to be singing these. These are the songs of the day. And of course, that's screaming at us all the time now. I mean, immediacy of sung worship. You only have to literally turn on YouTube or iTunes or whatever, week in, week out, and there is a new song. And this is the new greatest song that is sweeping the earth. And there's a temptation that we should be singing that on Sunday. Are we being led more now by the influence of that culture than actually by listening to the voice of God? And what's God saying for our community? What's he saying for us in our place in this moment of time? So worship leaders, you're up against it. But be wise. Listen to the voice of God into your community and your context. What is being preached? What's being said? Where are you at? What's God saying? And what songs reflect that? What songs bring the soundtrack to the life of your people in that moment of time? So I believe the antidote to some of the things that we're seeing is that convergence of community and experience together. Trend number two, a convergence of global and local. A convergence of global and local. As we've just said, I mean, we can't get away from this. We are living in an age of a global sound. There are some wonderful beauties to that. The global sound means I can step into this conference this week and sing songs that last Sunday in the UK we were singing. It draws us together. It unites us. We have a common sound. We have a commonality to our worship. We understand what we're saying. There's a global expression that's taking place, certainly across the Western church. It's actually being picked up by the wider church than that as well. In fact, you can go into many African nations or many Eastern Asian nations and pick up the very same songs. So we are now in that, and there's a beauty to it. It's a uniting beauty to it. It also raises our level of excellence. Songwriting and songs have gone from the local expression, and they've been infused now with a global expression, which raises the bar. It raises the bar for our songwriting. Songwriters are rolling their sleeves up and understanding that they've got to dig deeper. They've got to write more contextually relevant songs for their local, but also in a ways that can capture those who are now globally aware. So there's great benefits, but of course, again, note to worship leaders, there are some negatives to this. That global sound and receiving that global sound into your local house does carry with it some responsibilities that you and I have to work our way through. The first is that we're now very used to an anthemic sound. We're very used to singing anthems in the life of the church. We've become conditioned now to the big chorus. I don't know if you note this when you're with your people, but we actually bodily reflect more along the route of what the song is doing, how the song is leading us. More people will raise their hands in an anthemic chorus than they will in the verses of a song. So we're being led in this anthem of praise, which is wonderful in many ways. But of course, contextualizing our local churches, you have to contextualize it. Sometimes we can't sing as high as you can sing in a stadium. Okay, you have to bring it down. You have to literally change the key so that it allows itself to be embodied in the body of Christ. There are notes that in this room we're going to struggle to sing. And the notes in a stadium that we're going to all soar to reach. Okay, so be conscious of those sort of things. But secondly, worship leaders, don't just copy. You know, there's a tendency, isn't there, nowadays? You know, things like multitracks.com allow us to play along to the very sound that has been captured and recorded on the album that we're all listening to. So it allows us to become the same sound that we are playing on our iPods or iPhones or in our cars. So therefore, when people walk into it, they feel very comfortable with that in our gatherings. But of course, the danger is that it robs us of the creativity that is inherently built into us, that God has placed in us. And actually, as we reflect it, we reflect the Creator God. And so be people who wisely handle those things. You know, I'm a big believer in the excellence of what's coming across the nations and drawing us to that. And we use click tracks and we use tracks and all those sort of things. But in the midst of all of that, we're also trying to seek the creative God who is leading us in our creativity. So we don't always just copy. Imagine, for example, if music, and I know music is so scriptural, it's so biblical, but imagine if music wasn't our worship expression, if that wasn't at the centrality of some of our worship expression and our styles. Imagine if art was, for a moment. Imagine if painting was the thing that all of us were being led into the expression. Imagine for a moment that we all took a painting that had been painted in Australia last Sunday, and we all stood on the platform, we had a team of painters, and all they did was they copied that painting in Australia. Imagine how despondent we would be with that. Because all of a sudden we'd realise that actually we're not being led by the voice of God into our local, we're being led by an expression of something that we are copying and picking up. We've learned to paint by numbers. And one of the things I would encourage you as worship musicians, lead pastors, is to begin to go wider in our expression, celebrate again what's in our hand, and begin to understand that God has created a unique blueprint for you in your local expression. As I was researching this particular area in the life of the trends that I discovered, I picked up some wonderful online thoughts by a gentleman called Dr. Jeremy Perigo. And I had no idea he was going to be here at the conference. I was going to show two of his quotes on here. Had no idea. And this is only God, isn't it? But yesterday, in one of our pre-conference sessions, we were asked to pray for one another. And I go and pray for Jeremy. I don't know him. Never met him before. Lay my hands on him. And I've got written in my notes two of his quotes here. And then it dawns on me through the course of the day, as he stands up with his wife last night and says, "This is who I am and I'm here." I'm like, thank you, Jesus. I don't have to show the quotes off. Would you join me in welcoming Dr. Jeremy as he joins me just for a moment? Have we got a microphone that, can we take one of those? Wonderful. So Jeremy, we crossed paths yesterday. You've been in the UK for 6 or 7 years now, working into the London School of Theology. And I know of your work through the wonderful world of the internet. We'd never met, but your thoughts and the processing that you've been doing around global and local, you use this phrase that in the future there'll be a more global and more local sound. Can you explain some of that for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think on one end, this global sound that all of us are being impacted on, the British academic side of me looks at it and says, these are just 5 or 6 white guys, white men, writing songs that are flowing along mass media and that have this massive engine behind it, economic engine. Now, that's the critical analytical side of me. But on the other, I think I was sitting with Pastor Brian in London in our flat, and we were talking about how great is our God, a little bit of what you just said. I mean, in the last year, I've sang that in Kurdish, Arabic, Korean, Armenian, English, German, and sometimes at the same location. And that song by a pretty amazing white guy who plays guitar pretty well and looks good in skinny jeans.
Yeah.
I'm okay. You can say that. You can say other men look good in skinny jeans. Come on. I'm a slightly woke Midwesterner. we have that opportunity to gather together, and that's happening today. And in my mind, that is the spirit. That's the sacramentality of these songs that can gather us from every culture, every nation, every tribe, and every tongue at the same time.
Yeah.
What you were saying, like that local sound has to come forth. And honestly, a caveat, because I'm talking to worshipers and pastors, the first time you write a song, it's going to be really bad. Okay, maybe one in a room like this that would be good. The second time, the third time. And so as you begin to express this local sound, you've got to stop comparing it.
Yeah.
Pastors, this is for you too. As your worship leader writes their first song and you say, oh yeah, I heard at the conference to release the local sound. To recognize that song may not fit in a congregation of 3,000 where everyone's expecting you to be like Jonathan Helfser and raise a hallelujah. Like the expectations of our congregation aren't towards the local right now. And so what we have to do is begin to write those, but to recognize that the first painting your kid does,
it's great.
It's special, it's nice, it's good for the grandparents, it's good to send in the mail. But it's not going to be in the museum.
Yeah,
but those local sounds have to come forth. Because we aren't just a congregation of anthems. There's pain, there's joy, there's celebrations in your community. And again, God is worthy of every song, every tribe, every tongue.
Wonderful. Yeah. Jeremy, thank you so much. Bless you. Bless you. Wonderful. The other beautiful thing that I see taking place as part of this global and local convergence is the development of our multicultural worship. And I, as a Brit, we're at the beginning of this phase, I believe. We're very much beginning to see that in our local church. But there is something wonderful. And again, if you see it from a global perspective, when a Michael W. Smith picks up a song by a Nigerian worship leader called Sinash, and begins to draw on the richness of what he's seeing across culture, that's a good thing. We're starting to see good things. You know, we start to see the band Leland, who very recently have partnered with a British black worship leader, Noel Robinson, and it's a wonderful convergence. We start to see Travis Green, Stephanie Gretzinger, Brandon Lake, Tasha, we sang the song, Tasha Cobbs Leonard. There's this wonderful sense that we're starting to see a convergence of cultures that is beginning to represent a global sound to us. And I believe we're at the early stages of that. We're at the early stages of it. It's been a joy to see our two worship teams over the last two sessions really embrace that and begin to celebrate that and begin to release the sound. But I believe there's going to be some steps forward in it in the coming years. There'll be some steps forward that move us, and forgive my language, but from multicultural to intercultural, this sense that we're working together, we are one, this wonderful sense of us coming together. In England, in Lincoln, We're discovering this over just the last few years. I suppose over the last 10 to 15 years, we've had a great influx of African nations into the city, Eastern Europeans into the city as well. Those from Asia have come into our city. And we're beginning to see that in the life of the church. Every Sunday, we have a connect group, a small group gathering of Nigerians. And then once a month, Nigerians from across the region gather together for an overseas fellowship of Nigerian Christians. And we had an incredible couple as part of that who said 15, 20 years ago that what they were seeing in the nation was nations who would come to England and then form churches around the cultural relevance of their nation. So we'd see an Ethiopian church, we'd see a Nigerian church. But they said, as for me and my house, we're going to celebrate something that's greater than that. We're looking for that golden thread of us coming together, the united church. So I believe that we're going to see, and I believe it's going to be seen. At the moment, if you look online, you see it, and it's a bit forced. It's forced a little bit by record companies trying to make things happen. It's that sense of, you know, we're responding. The Leland and Noel Robinson is because they are under the same label. So we have to go beyond and see beyond that. But the local church is actually where we'll see this intercultural, wonderful convergence begin to take place. So I believe there's a convergence of global and local. Thirdly, I'm going to get really practical for a moment. I believe there's a convergence of melody, harmony, and rhythm that we are returning to. Now, let me... So at the core of this point is I want to draw us to melody again. I want to draw us back to melody. I think over the last few years, really practically, we've begun to be drawn towards rhythm. I was chatting with someone over breakfast today who said, doesn't it feel like we're singing more words per beat in every single phrase? It absolutely does, doesn't it? Now, have you tried to sing Another in the Fire recently? The verses of that are very different, difficult culturally, congregationally, for us to fit all the words in, especially when a worship leader begins to change the meter or the placement of those words. All of us a sudden become listeners. We become not engaged in worship anymore, but we are passive. We're no longer active. And we have to be careful with the rhythmic nature of our songs. Many of you will know lots more about history of music than I do, but let's just do a real quick snapshot of the history of church music. So right at the beginning of church music, singing is always played an incredibly important part. It's biblical, it's scriptural. We're encouraged to sing unto the Lord a new song. There's singing built very into the essence of the scriptures. It's both Old Testament and New Testament. When you see Paul and Silas in a prison, they sing. The prison walls come tumbling down. It's this nature of the church. The church has always sung. But of course, at the early church, that was a chant. It was an unaccompanied solo voice or gathered voice together, and we chanted. It had very little rhythmic or harmonic content to it. It was very much a melody. Melody was at the core of what we did. So let's skip forward a number of hundreds of years into the Renaissance period, 1400s to 1600s. And into that period of time, we start to see harmony being added in. Instrumentation gets added in. And melody now gets accompanied by harmony. And then, of course, Bach comes along, 1685. Is born and starts writing counterpoint and starts writing melodies within melodies. And we get a complexity to European classical music at that point that begins to enrich melody with harmony and other melodic contents. And then let's move us forward now into perhaps an American context. Obviously, folk music and the understanding of folk music, certainly in the late 19th and 20th centuries, would incorporate the song of the local, and that was infused by some of the UK sound. You'd get British and Irish country songs that would come in, and then really America has developed that into country. And of course, you had spiritual songs in America as well, and of course, that's been developed into gospel, R&B, etc. And then over the course of the 20th century, all of that became a melting pot into jazz, and then a melting pot into rock. And at the core of rock is rhythm. So we have moved from melody through harmony, and now we're in a phase where rhythm is actually the driving nature of the sounds that we and the songs that we hear. And I think the culmination of this actually happened a few years ago, where a lot of our songs were mono melodic, really. We would sing phrases over three or four bars that all stayed on the same note. And we became rhythmically driven rather than melodically driven. We moved from actually where we were in the kind of renaissance of our sung worship in the 70s, which was very melodic, very beautiful in its melody. But we went, oh, that's quaint. Isn't that a bit nice? And then we went very, very rhythmic. And I believe now there's a bit of a convergence where actually melody is returning into the songs that we sing. And that's only a good thing. So stay with me just for a minute here, because I'm going to stretch us a little bit. I'm not saying this is necessarily in Scripture, but let me just go with you. Come with me on a couple of things here. So I would say that there is a structure to songwriting that actually looks at melody being the most important, harmony being the second most important, and rhythm being the third most important. And those three elements being in that order. Psalm 68, verse 25 says this. In the front are the singers, melody. After them, the musicians, harmony. And with them are the young women playing the timbrels, rhythm. This sense that actually melody, harmony, and rhythm. 1 Thessalonians 5, 23 reminds us that we are spirit, soul, and body. So come with me just on this for a moment. What if rhythm is intrinsically linked to the body? What if harmony is intrinsically linked to the soul? But what if melody is intrinsically linked to the spirit? I love that breakout session where we're going to talk about the corporate nature of singing and what happens in that. What if we begun to understand that God has given us the gift of music? And it's not solely as a gift for humanity, but it's a gift for us in order to engage with a creator God. He's given us something where rhythm, harmony, and melody allow us, body, soul, and spirit, to connect with him. I wonder whether, though, we've begun to become a bit accustomed more so to the rhythm and the harmony. Let's just look at our band makeup just for a moment. There is no longer a solely melodic instrument in our band setups. Across the earth, mostly nowadays, we have rhythmic elements. We've got bass and percussion here, which are drums and percussion, which are wonderful. Then we've got harmony instruments, starting with the fundamentals of the harmony, the bass, guitar, and then guitarists and keyboard players. Keyboard players are predominantly being asked now to play harmony, and then our melody is the singing on top of that. But we've lost that beauty of the melodic instruments in there. Last Sunday at Alive, we introduced back into our flow a flautist. It's the first time we've done that in years. And she played for one song. And there was a tangible moment in the presence of the people of, this is refreshing. There's something in this. Now, I'm not advocating that we all of a sudden dust off the flutes underneath our beds and, you know, get out the cello that once you studied when you were at school or university. But there is something wonderful that our spirits respond to around melody. So I believe there's a convergence of melody, harmony, and rhythm. So, note to worship leaders, songwriters, let's return to melody. Let's capture some wonderful melodies. Write songs that are singable, congregational, and memorable. But be aware we're in an age of immediacy. Songwriting's a craft. You have to dig in. It takes time. It's something you have to give of yourself to. You have to dig deep in. As Jeremy said, you know, the first songs we write aren't going to be great. But over time, you'll develop them, and those things will begin to come out of you. Write for the local church. You know, if God breathes upon that, it goes around the world, brilliant. But write for your local church. Write for the people of God that God has placed you in, that marriage of community and experience. And as Jeremy said, pastors, senior pastors, champion the local song. Champion your local creative songwriters. It's difficult. They're up against it. You know, they're putting their very creative essence out there. And the first thing that we often do, not as senior pastors, but they will face a wall of critique. It's not as good as, doesn't sound as good. You know, if you change that, it will be better. All of those things. And all of that becomes a bit despondent for a songwriter. So celebrate your songwriters. Celebrate those who are bringing songs into the life of the local church. And let's see what God does as he breathes upon the local church singing together. So a convergence of melody, harmony, and rhythm. Let's go a little bit deeper now. Number four. Trend number four, and this really is reflecting, I think, the heart of Pastor Dan and the heart of what's being spoken across this conference. But there really is, I believe, becoming a convergence of transcendence and imminence. Now, of course, I'm not talking about in God. In God, it's already converged. God is transcendent and he is imminent. The God we worship is the God who is outside of it all. He is above it all. He is the sovereign one. He is glorious in his very nature. He is unapproachable, and yet he is approachable. This sense that he is outside of it all, there is the transcendent nature of God really means God and everything else that isn't God. This sense, and one of the things I would look to encourage and push us and walk us towards is that sense of returning the transcendent nature of God into our understanding, our practice, and our patterns. Having at the core of who we are a wonderful returning to understanding that God is transcendent and he is imminent. He is both above and he is close. We've become very, very comfortable with the closeness of God. We've become very comfortable with the friendship of God. We've become very comfortable with the nearness of God. We sing lots of songs about the imminence of Jesus with us, God, Christ with us, God with us, the hope of glory, the standing alongside us, this walking with us. We sang some this morning, you know, God walking us through water. There's a lot of that in the very fabric of our songs at this moment of time. But can I encourage all of us to once again recapture the transcendent nature of God in our sung worship? You see, the Bible, its very essence is that wonderful journey of transcendent to imminent. This sense of God is above and he's with us. You look through that through creation. You can look through that at the story of God walking with Moses and his people. Of course, it culminates in the story of Jesus. Jesus, who was before all things, and then he is with us, God with us, Emmanuel. One of the things that's come into the church recently is that we start with the imminence of God. We start from that place. But when we begin to converge transcendence and imminence, we begin to understand that actually we allow ourselves to be modeling ourselves and our practices and our sacramental processes with what God is modeling through Scripture. That we start understanding who God is. We start from a place of understanding and putting in front of our people that we are leading week in, week out, that he is the transcendent one, that he is above and beyond. I wonder if you checked your song lists and looked through the things that we were singing in the life of our church and used what Bob Kaufman calls the 10-year check. You know, if we're going to sing this song or these songs, this group of songs for the next 10 years, what would our people know about God? What would they understand about him? What narrative would they have to be singing? What would be the course of their sung life? If we sang what we're singing globally at the moment for the next 10 years, we might find ourselves in quite a narrow understanding of who our God is. And I wonder whether, when we begin to understand the transcendent and imminent nature of our God, whether we could begin to have a wider understanding of who he is. Romans 11, verse 33 reminds us, oh, the depths of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and how inscrutable are his ways. Have we lost some of that in our context of our singing? That actually we don't have the words to describe our God. Sometimes our songs have put our God into quite a small box, but we don't have the words to describe how vast he is. The God without measure. And sometimes I wonder whether in our context we need a returning to some of that in our very understanding. But then also in our practice, I believe that if we begin to get a biblical understanding of transcendence and then immanence and begin to practice that in our patterns, that we could begin to understand that there is a flow of our sung worship that starts with the transcendent nature of God and moves us towards the imminent nature of our God. Yesterday in our pre-conference meetings, Pastor Dan mentioned the tabernacle flow of worship, where we start with gate songs, then we move to the outer court, then we move through into the inner court, and then, of course, we are now invited into the Holy of Holies. That really is a transcendent to imminent process in our walk through the practices that we do each and every week. I wonder whether, if we could begin to recapture some of that, we'd align ourselves with a biblical model of worship. Just a quick phrase and thoughts for worship leaders. How you start is so important. Create a sense of expectation that it is God himself who is inviting us, and establish the nature and character of God as the exclusive and sole object of Christian worship. The first song that we choose can set us up for a real understanding of who God is in the center of this. I'd love the last two times we've gathered, because we've gathered with a call to worship over our gatherings. We've started with a biblical explanation of why we're doing what we do and a call to those things. I love that. I love that sense of actually we're aligning ourselves again with the God who is calling us into this. He's inviting us into this wonderful moment of time. But not only should it inform our practices, it is now, and there's a cry in the generations coming through for it to inform our patterns. Kerry Newhoff says this: younger adults are deeply craving something, deeply craving connection and transcendence. Young adults are looking for something or someone beyond themselves, an experience that can't be reduced, fully explained, or isn't even fully definable, which is, of course, part of the character of God. He is so much bigger than us. Within me, there's a desire, I think, always to allow the little boy inside of me to come alive. On the plane over here, I caught a little bit of that Elton John film, Rocket Man. And in the middle of there, there's the character who's playing Elton John at the age of, I don't know, 19, 20, sits at the piano and plays Your Song. And it awoke in me that moment of time when I was, as a teenage boy, sitting playing some songs at the piano, just in love with Jesus. Sat in that place where actually I was encountering the transcendent nature of God and the immanent nature of God. I was engaged in song worship at a level that didn't matter about any of this, didn't matter about the trappings and all the things that we did. It's about me connecting with who he is. On the train down to the airport a couple of days ago, I was at that unearthly hour where I saw a sunrise. And it was a glorious and beautiful sunrise. One of those moments where I was sitting there on the train, looked out of the window, and my breath was taken away. That capture again of the God who is transcendent. The God. And I believe the patterns of our life, we're looking for that. I don't believe it's solely young people. I believe you and I are looking for that. We're designed for it. We're designed to be people who engage with God as his transcendent nature and also his immanent nature. But worship leaders, how do we do that? How do we create environments of that? Well, of course, the tendency or the natural progression would feel if God is big, then we should go bigger. We should create moments that look bigger, that reflect the bigness of God. But actually, I believe we're understanding that it's not in the bigness that we reflect the bigness of God. It's actually in the whisper. It's in the God who speaks to us in the quiet and in whispers. I wonder whether the culture of Christianity is beginning to awaken itself and become awakened to practices that have harnessed the church for years, countless years. Things like breath prayers. We prayed a breath prayer last night when we sang, "Come Holy Spirit." Well, we just sang words that align themselves with what God is doing in this place. Words that allow us. Fasting and feasting. Those kind of principles in our life, etc. Final couple of things. I believe there's a convergence of the charismatic and the Eucharistic. We're going to talk loads more about that over the next few days. Dan calls this ancient future worship. Andrew Wilson calls it this, Eucharismatic. This sense of us having Eucharistic and charismatic worship at the very core of who we are. There's, in the UK, there's been an emergence, really, again, of fresh expressions of church that have captured the liturgical worship of the ages. And there's been a movement of people towards that. You know, it's Christmas and Easter, our cathedrals are now full. People are re-looking for and re-trying to discover ancient pathways. But also there's a move from some of our charismatic churches into places that have a level of rootedness in liturgical practice as well. I believe that there is a convergence that can take place when the charismatic and the Eucharistic can come together, where we can actually celebrate those ancient pathways, but with the breath of the Spirit in them. You know, where we celebrate what took place in this room this morning, this sense of calling for this is a move, but also, as was referenced so wonderfully last night, our center point of gathering is the table. And our final trend is this. We're going to hear loads more about the trend we've just heard as Dan speaks, I think, tonight. But our final trend that I see this is a convergence of worship and mission. It's one of the things that I believe has reimagined and rebirthed in the life of the church over the last number of years. This sense of the gathering is part of who we are, but actually we gather in order that we go from this place as Christ's ambassadors. And wherever God has placed us, we are Romans 12 worshippers. We are in spirit and in truth living stones, living out our worship wherever we are. So worship leaders and worship pastors and teams, how do we prepare our people for that? What are the songs that they're carrying into their workplaces each and every week? What does it look like to sing an anthem in my place of work? What songs are we preparing, giving people as the tools and the equipping for them in their worlds of mission? The word in the New Testament, of course, most prominently used for worship is proskuneo, the laying down of ourselves, the lying before God, the humbling of ourselves. But Romans 12 introduces a brand new word. It's latreia, which means our spiritual service or our worship of God. It says this, therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship, or the King James Version, or reasonable service. Our worship is no longer contained within the gathered space, but our worship we are fully understanding and we're living out now as living stones wherever God has placed us. And there's a convergence of the two. A few years ago, the social action really gripped the church, and there was a tendency, certainly in UK church, for that to split the church, those who love to gather and those who love to be scattered. But actually, I believe in God, there's a convergence that's coming, where we stand together, and then we know that we go from this place together. It will be the richness of God at work in his people. So I humbly offer us some thoughts this morning, some convergence thoughts, some places of trends that are taking place. You may or may not yet see those in the life of your local church. They may, of course, be things that are UK specific, but I lay them at your feet and pray them through. If any of them sit with your local church, then process them. And as was said last night by Glenn, you know, don't change everything this Sunday because it will not land. But, you know, over time, begin to process some of those things. Begin to ask those questions of God. God, what are you doing at this moment in worship? And what are you doing in this local context? And let's have a convergence of these wonderful strands as they come together, which will enrich us, unite us, and make us stronger as the body of Christ as we move forward together. God bless you. It's been an honor to be a part of you this morning. Bless you.
Great job. Awesome, Howard. That was tremendous. Well, this session is going to conclude in about 3 or 4 minutes, but we have time right now. If you have a question you'd like to ask Howard, why don't you join me on the platform? Out of his 6 points, and let me just... Liam, if you could run those 6 points quickly, we'll just review them and see if it triggers a couple of questions, and then we're going to take a break. Trend number one, let's say it together, a convergence of community and experience. Let's say it together out loud. Number two, a convergence of global and local. Number three, a convergence of melody, harmony, and rhythm. Number four, a convergence of transcendence and eminence. Number five, a convergence of charismatic and eucharistic. And number six, a convergence of worship and mission. Each of those deserve a full hour of unpacking, and he did an awesome job. So a couple of questions. You don't need a mic. Just stand and ask. Or thanks, Joel.
Thank you. That was great. I hope this doesn't sound like a snotty question. It's really meant to be very practical. Yeah. As we move forward with songwriting in our own congregations, we have debuted some local people over the times, and some of them are awesome. Some of them are quite dreadful. Like, how do you pastor and encourage, but like the whole congregation can't be made to sing this thing for 10 more years. It's just, and also music is only like the hottest button opinion issue in any church ever. So like practically, how do you respond to that?
It's a great question. It's a great question, which is the essence of what it is to lead people, isn't it? It's the essence of being real and honest with one another. Because it's actually not helpful for that person to be living in a place where everyone around them is saying, you ain't great. You know, that does not help that person. So it is the character and heart of God, I believe, to actually call us into where God has us placed. And for some of us, I have people who come to me and bring me songs left, right, and center all the time. And how do you graciously walk with that person and actually say, look, it's not all there at the moment? And so some of the things that I would do is I would have, if they're in your team, if they're working with you and you have a close relationship, is I would have honest conversations with that person. I would come alongside that person and actually draw out where they are excelling themselves. And in that, the problem with songwriting and songs is they're so public, they're so front and center, and they're so attractive. Everybody wants to have written the next big hit. Everybody wants to have their song being sung if they're a musician, etc. So I think foster in you a culture of honesty, foster in you a culture of walking with one another. All of this gets handled in relationships, I think. It gets handled and worked out so well when you know one another, you love one another, and you can walk together. The other thing that I would steer you towards is collaborative songwriting, where people can bring an idea and others can fuse ideas into that. That I see a freshness of that in the global sound, but I also see a freshness of that in the local sound, that we're not supposed to be isolated, we're supposed to work and walk together. And in that, someone's initial idea that they've developed into the full song may actually become a way greater and better song if someone else takes the initial idea and develops it into the fullness of a song. Hopefully a couple of things can help you there.
So you touched on this some with the transcendence and immanence and global and local. How do you create in your worship team and your congregation a balanced set list? And what I mean by that is it feels that with the immanence and the global, that the only thing that we're getting, and you know, maybe that's an overgeneralization, is that a lot of it is circumstantial, like personal, well, you know, breakthrough and overcoming something. It seems like no one's really writing praise music anymore. You know, the Vineyard, you know, there's some in there. So now, you know, you're pulling out songs that are, you know, 10 years old because nobody's writing that, you know. So how do you create a more balanced set list that is converging with the transcendence and with the local, but is not really being reflected, I don't think, personally, in the CCM world?
It's a great question and a great point. I agree with you. In the CCM world, we are struggling, I think, certainly in the transcendent nature of God, reflecting that in songs, but also in the element of praise. I would draw us as well to psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, that actually there's a call over the church. There's a pattern in that. There's a structure of things that we can sing. So if you are writing, I'd encourage you to be writing from the great songbook of the Bible, to actually be rewriting and understanding the great words of truth that have carried for countless centuries. And those bring us a voice of praise in so many areas. And also, is there a convergence of musical styles? Because there are other musical styles that carry the essence and heart of them praise. Gospel music, at the very essence, has a greater sound of praise in it than CCM currently does. And for me, the convergence of the global and local also looks at the convergence of musical styles that have become siloed. And actually, when we can begin to bridge the gaps of those silos, we get a greater palette and a greater sound to work from.
So and Dan, you've talked about this before. The landscape is still dominated, particularly when you're in a multi-ethnic church. Landscape is still dominated by white musicians, white songwriters, white worship leaders, etc. Now what you're starting to see is white songwriters, white worship leaders are incorporating blacks into their songs, but it's still very much a back row mentality. So you see the, and it's still very much a white catalog. It's still very much white music that they're just incorporating blacks instead of playing black music. So how, and this also affects the prowess, the musical prowess of the musicians. So you have guitar players, for example, that play, I'm trying to be sensitive here, that play melodically with 100 pedals that can't play a jazz chord or anything to save their life. So and that sound is copied over and over and over and over again. I want to see the guy that comes in and rips with the prowess, and typically those guys are the black players in the black churches. So how do we get to that place?
Such a great question. Such a great question. I have no answers because I'm not there. I am not there. I know someone who does, though. Here she is.
Sorry, I just had to jump in. Oh, that's such a great question. I'm Nikki, by the way. I'm Nikki Lerner. Sorry. I'm Pastor Dan. I have the next session, yeah, so please come after lunch. I will say this, being in a multi-ethnic church, Chris, thank you for bringing that up, is, I'll talk about this later, but one thing you have to know is that everything we see in CCM, right, and there's nothing wrong with it. Let me just make that clear. Everything we see in CCM is termed normal. And I say that just because if you're not aware of that, if you don't see culture as everybody's an ethnic group, yeah, right? If you see that as that is a expression of, oftentimes this is a generalization, but white American culture. And so it actually, what it requires is white American culture who are used to four guitar chords, to say, let me step into the experience of non-white American people and learn. Yep. And that's not always passed down. It's one of those things that everything's passed down culturally. Sometimes it's just when you're part of the majority culture, that's not passed down to you because every other person's culture is an elective. Yours is a required course. So, and I don't say that to make you upset. I just say that to make you aware, to say that you just have to know, particularly if you're a white American in the room, that it's going to take a level of awareness for you to say, let me go sit with somebody who's an amazing jazz player and say, can you teach me? That's how you use your privilege.
Wow. So good.
Hallelujah. That's a great promo for Nikki's afternoon session. That's awesome. If you want to connect with Howard over lunch, let's do that. You've all been sitting a long time, been very attentive. Let's give it up for Howard.